Tappings of BBC 40 centimetre acetate discs. Numbers 18939 and 18940. Four sides. The future of socialism. From London Calling Asia on the 28th of December 1952.
Good evening and welcome to another meeting of the Asian Club. Tonight, a large studio audience has gathered here to put questions to our two distinguished visitors, Mr. Hugh Gateskill MP and Mr. Anaran Bevan MP. They are both Privy Councillors and they're both members of the Parliamentary Committee of the Labour Party, which, as you all know, is the Socialist Shadow Cabinet. Now, Mr. Bevan is the Member of Parliament for the Ebb Vale Division of Monmouthshire, a seat which he's held since 1929. From 1945 to 1951, he was the Minister of Health in the Labour government, and for a short time in 1951, he was Minister of Labour and National Service. And he has been, in his time, editor of that left-wing paper, Tribune. Now, Mr. Hugh Gateskill is the Member of Parliament for South Leeds. He became Chancellor of the Exchequer in the last Labour government. He's also been Minister of State for Economic Affairs and Minister of Fuel and Power. At one time, he was the head of the Department of Political Economy in London University. Now, Mr. Gateskill and Mr. Bevan have agreed tonight to be questioned on the future of socialism in Britain. And now I'm going to hand over to the first questioner.
P.B. Nair from India. Do you think that Britain is rapidly progressing towards socialism? If so, do you think that the government is trying to put the clock back by denationalizing some of the nationalized industries? In a future socialist government, what further nationalization would you advocate?
Well, now, that was from Mr. P.B. Nair of India, and he asked, do you think that Britain is rapidly progressing towards socialism? If so, do you think that the government, that's the Conservative government, is trying to put the clock back by denationalizing some of the nationalized industries? In a future socialist government, what further nationalisation would you advocate? Mr. Hugh Gateskill.
Well, just at the moment, under a Conservative government, Britain is progressing away from socialism fairly rapidly, but not as rapidly as it would be if we didn't have a strong and virile Labour opposition. Certainly, the government is trying to put the clock back by denationalising road transport and steel. We spend most of our time in the House of Commons at the moment on the committee stage of the Road Transport Bill. We should like to have a lot more time, but unfortunately the government has imposed what we call the guillotine, which limits the time that we can discuss this extremely bad measure. Now, the third part of the question, what further nationalisation would you advocate? Well, this is a question which it's perhaps easier for me to tackle than it is for Mr. Bevan, because he's a member of the National Executive of the party, which is considering precisely this and other problems of our future policy, whereas I am not a member of that executive and therefore a little freer. My view is, that first of all, of course, we shall have to put back the two measures that the government are introducing now. We shall have to renationalize road transport and steel. Beyond that, there are various suggestions that have been made. We are a democratic party, and we have to abide by, and we do abide by, a parliamentary procedure, and of course there is a limit to what you can do in any one parliament. Some people, for instance, believe that the nationalization of the land in some form or other is a measure which has much to commend it from the point of view of stimulating food production. There is also quite a school of thought which favours the nationalisation of the aircraft industry. There are also proposals which are being discussed, I think, to nationalise the heavy chemical industry. But I think the real way and the best way to deal with this question is to make a short list, as it were, of the industries which obviously come up for consideration, discuss them with the trade unions, and then decide which of these you want definitely to put into your program.
Well, I think that was a fairly comprehensive answer, and now may I ask Mr. Anaren Bevan if he has anything to add to it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I find myself in a most unusual position because the obligations of discretion rest heavily upon me, mm-hmm. and Mr. Gateskill is as free as air. However, I'll try and do my best to overcome the handicap. In the first place, of course, I don't think we are progressing very rapidly towards socialism in Britain. I think it would have been far better for us if we had gone a little bit more rapidly in that direction. And of course, as Hugh Gateskill has already said, we are now slipping back under a conservative administration. How far they may be able actually to denationalize steel, I think is problematical. Mm-hmm. Because although they may pass the legislation, there is an extraordinary reluctance on the part of the capitalists to take it back. It's far more difficult to unscramble than many people imagined. And I think that Mr. Churchill will have very many headaches before he is able to hand the steel industry back to private enterprise. Now, what a future Labour government will do, of course, is conjectural. And as we are already engaged in formulating policy, and we've had a very interesting weekend. And the press has been full of a remarkable bout of misinformed speculation as to what has happened. However, I think I can go as far as to say that it looks very hopeful indeed. It looks as if we shall be able to produce a program which will not only unite the party as a whole, but take us a substantial step towards more socialism in Great Britain.
Well, now I think we must have a few supplementary questions to these two answers, and while the questioners are getting ready, I wonder if I could ask Mr. Bevan if he has anything to add to the list which Mr. Gateskill put up for our consideration for public ownership. I think we had land in some form or another, the aircraft industry, and heavy chemicals. Is there anything else?
No, I'm not going to add anything to that list, because if I did, it would give the game away completely.
Well, it's not for me as a chairman to say that he called it a game and I didn't. Well, then I think perhaps we'd better turn to the second question which we have tonight. And that second question comes from Mr.
My name is P.G. Mavelankar and I come from India. My first question is specifically to Mr. Bevan. And before I ask, may I request him to give rather a detailed reply rather than say just yes or no. Do you think the House of Commons to be an effective instrument to implement further nationalization and to achieve real socialism? If not, will you advocate doing away with the parliamentary machine so that some more effective means could achieve the desired end?
Well, that question comes from Mr. Mavelankar of India, and it's addressed to Mr. Bevan only, and it is, do you think the House of Commons to be an effective instrument to implement further nationalization and to achieve real socialism? If not, will you advocate doing away with the parliamentary machine so that some more effective means could achieve the desired end? Mr. Bevan.
Well, now, this is a very interesting question. I have stated on many occasions, and indeed I have written recently in a book, that I think that the parliamentary system of Great Britain is so flexible that it can be used as an instrument for the achievement of socialism. We are not in this country, again, up against the difficulties of a written constitution. There is no Supreme Court to set aside what we do. Parliament is sovereign, and the elected representatives of the people in the House of Commons are supreme. And therefore, there is no constitutional inhibition to whatever that instrument does. Therefore, I think it can be regarded as an effective instrument for the accomplishment of socialism. Now, of course, many people will say that the parliamentary process is tedious and that it takes a long time. But as a matter of fact, I think the state of the world shows at the moment that parliamentary democracy, as it is being used in Great Britain, is a very much more rapid way of achieving the transformation of society than is dictatorship. That is exactly what is being proved at the moment, that that there is no alternative to representative processes except civil war. And that's the most tedious and procrastinating of all methods of achieving change, as we have found. And indeed, not only that, but after we have seen revolutionary changes made in some parts of the world, we find that, as we have just seen in Czechoslovakia, changes in leadership and changes in policy accomplished only by horrible purges of various sorts. So this is not only an effective way of doing the job, but is a civilized way of doing it too. But that's not to say, and the very last person to say, that when property has been transferred by parliamentary means from private hands to public hands, that necessarily you have accomplished socialism. You've done no such thing. All you will have done is to make a change of power and make the and make it easier to accomplish socialism. A socialist state can only be achieved if the people themselves, after property has been transferred to public hands, have an opportunity of administering it, determining the policies to be carried out with respect to it, and emotionally and intellectually identify themselves with it.
Well, Mr. Mavalenka, have you anything you'd like to ask in addition to that?
Well, I thank very much indeed, Mr. Bevan, for your very clear answer. And in fact, I was prompted to ask that question because I read your very instructive book, In Place of Fear. Many people seem to have thought that you were anti-parliamentary democracy. I am glad to hear that from you now. But arising out of your point just now, may I ask just one short supplementary? It is this. Do you think, therefore, that it is not only the parliament alone, but also people outside who will have to work side by side with the parliament to achieve what you call as socialism or democratic socialism?
Oh, yes. Parliament is only one, of course, the most important, but only one of the instruments of representative government. There are the trade unions, very important organizations indeed, concerned in the administration of industry. And also, what is not sufficiently recognized, very important institutions for the training of people to take part in the administration of industry. I believe it was Heine, German poet, who came to this country in 1870, I think, somewhere about then, who said that after having seen the working class of England and saw how savage and barbarous they were, which our Indian friends might remember, he was appalled at the thought of entrusting the government of Great Britain to people of that sort, and Heine was a socialist. Well, what's happened in the meantime is that by means of the trade unions and by means of all kinds of voluntary institutions, we have called into existence a generation of men and women that have never been seen before in the history of Great Britain and who can safely be entrusted with the administration of large undertakings.
Well, now, are there any others who would like to follow up this very interesting question? If not, at the risk of Mr. Mavalenka having a double ration, may we have the next supplementary question?
Well, what Mr. Bevan thought that the present rate of progression that the Labour Party is taking towards socialization, and if I may recall from my faint memory that since 1905 or 6, the Labour Party has been advocating the abolition of House of Lords. And this slow process of rather reformation, as I would call it, towards socialization. So instead, House of Lords being abolished, the only thing we find is that instead we have got Labour Lords in the House of Lords, but the House still remains, you see. And therefore, this reformation, how long, will it take to the true socialism? I think that's enough for the time.
It's very, very interesting. But you must not misunderstand the process. What's happening at the moment is That the House of Lords is being slowly atrophied. It is one of the glories of British history that we don't abolish anything. we actually keep it as a sort of atavism. Indeed, if you went to the House of Commons, as many of you have probably done, you will have seen all kinds of strange rituals going on, which at one time were very serious affairs indeed. For instance, you find the door locked in the face of a little man in satin breeches who comes and is not allowed to enter until he has first knocked on the door. Well, now, of course, that's just a nice little pleasant ritual that strangers can see. But at one time, it was a very important thing indeed. It was the exclusion of the king from the commons so that he couldn't intimidate them. And so we transfer people to the House of Lords. Because and it's a very convenient thing to do. But the House of Lords has no real power, because the only power that a second chamber has is the power of veto. And all the House of Lords has got is the power of delay. And that delay has been reduced to a year from the introduction of the bill in the House of Commons. From the second reading of the bill in the House of Commons. And, of course, if the House of Lords use their, even this power of delay, to hold very important legislation up, we could quite easily reduce the delay.
Well, I think now we'll allow Mr. Bevan to step down from the dock for a moment and ask Mr. Mavalenko if he'll put his next question to, I think, Mr. Gaitskell.
Yes, to be fair, I thought, Mr. Chairman, I should ask another question to Mr. Gaitskell specifically. Right. And it is this. Can you tell us, Mr. Gaitskell, that the objectives have, what the objectives have been to Mr. Bevan's policy? If it is wrong, why should the right wing of the Labour Party fear its growth? If right, why should not the whole party embrace it?
Well, I'll just repeat that question. It's addressed to Mr. Gaitskell, and it's this. Can you tell us what the objections have been to Mr. Bevan's policy? If it is wrong, why should the right wing of the Labour Party fear its growth? If it's right, why should not the whole party embrace it? Mr. Gaitskell.
Well, Mr. Chairman, first of all, I thought the use of the word dock was rather misconceived. So far as this question is concerned, I think I prefer the word witness box. But I think the question is really based on the assumption that there are wide differences of opinion on policy between Mr. Bevan and some of the rest of us. Now, of course, it is perfectly true that when he resigned from the government, he explained, as is customary here, his reasons for the resignation. I imagine that you are all familiar with those, and I need not repeat them. They were, of course, concerned with the particular rearmament program, which had been adopted, and with the budgetary policy for which I, in particular, was responsible. But I think that, frankly, the differences in policy, apart from those original causes of the resignation, have been very greatly exaggerated in the press here. No doubt they have good reasons for exaggerating them. But I must honestly say that so far this evening, Mr. Bevan has said nothing with which I could disagree at all. Though I haven't told him this before, there was very little indeed in his book, which I read with pleasure and interest, with which I disagreed. As he has just told us in answer to an earlier question, the National Executive of the Labour Party, composed of many different sections, what some people might call right-wing, some people might call left-wing, has been discussing the policy of the party, and I agree with him from the outside. It seems to me extremely likely that we shall be able, without any great difficulty, to agree on what our policy should be. And indeed, you know, if you were to take the Morecambe Conference, there was a very substantial measure of agreement. The three documents presented by the executive to the conference on foreign policy, on a plan for world mutual aid, on facing the facts, which was mostly concerned with our economic problems here, plus the two resolutions which were accepted by the executive, indicate an enormous measure of agreement over a very wide field. And therefore, if I may say so, I think the last two supplementary questions here do not really arise.
So I think we could sum that one up by saying it isn't wrong, so the right wing of the Labour Party needn't fear its growth, and it isn't right, so the whole party shouldn't embrace it. But I think we ought really to ask Mr. Anarin Bevan if he'd like to say anything on this.
Well, I'd like to first of all make one general observation that I think is pertinent. You must remember that when millions of people are trying to make up their mind about policy, they make an awful row. And there are in the Labour Party 8 to 9 million people. Mm-hmm. There are nearly a million individual members organized through the local parties, and about 7 to 8 millions in the trade unions. And so when we meet, we make an awful noise. Now, we are not like the Conservative Party, because in the Conservative Party, it's the leader who makes up his mind what the policy of the Conservative Party is. And if he wants to know what his confidential advisers think about it, they have a nice little country party, and they meet over dinner. Mm-hmm. Well, you can't get 8 million people around a dinner table. and therefore, there's bound to be a lot of discussion, and everybody says, what a terrible row, what splits there are. Mm. Well, of course, there's no splits inside the Conservative Party. Neither is there in a graveyard.
Now, are there any other supplementary questions on this particular one? Yes.
About 10 days back, I read in the Sunday Observer, especially in the leader or the editorial, that what Mr. Bevan advocated about 2 years ago is actually Mr. Churchill what he's doing now. I mean, would Mr. Gaskell agree with that viewpoint that Mr. Bevan's view has at last begun to prevail? And then would they in future rather give more consideration to his view?
Mr. Gaskell.
Well, I don't know that I want to start up an argument which has been going on for some time now again. But I wouldn't quite agree with that. Of course, it's really a question, I suppose, of how you interpret the decisions of January 1951. For my part, I always regarded those decisions as very provisional ones and subject to a good many qualifications, which indeed we all made very plain in the debate, the defence debate, which took place following the announcement of the defence programme. It's undeniably true that the economic situation for this country, having worsened considerably since then, it was necessary to spread out the defence programme further. There remains, if you like, the disagreement as to whether we should have started it at all or announced it at all, rather than started it at a lower level. Well, my own view on that is that in the then international situation in Europe, and to some extent in the Far East, there was a great deal to be said for this country giving a lead and showing that it was prepared to go in for a pretty substantial defence programme, subject to the qualifications, some of which I mentioned myself, that very likely, and I think I used these words, we would not in fact be spending the amount of money indicated as a broad notion of what was involved.
Well, of course, you know that's the most mischievous question that's been asked this evening. The fact is that I held the view then, and I think that subsequent events justified it, that the qualifying conditions attached to the rearmament had already begun to operate, and that therefore the rearmament program ought to be modified and extended over a longer number of years. I also held the view that the international situation at that time wasn't as tense and wasn't as grave as some of my friends believed. But that's always a matter of opinion. Right. They're intangibles that is very difficult to weigh. In any case, that water has gone under the bridge And I would not like to have anybody believe that any future statement of mine is bound to be as infallible as the one in 1951.
Next.
Though Mr. Bevan says that there's no split in the Labour Party, I feel there is a big majority following Mr. Bevan and another majority following Mr. Attlee. Do you think this one will eventually lead to a split between Mr. Attlee and Mr. Bevan, and ultimately result in the splitting of the socialist government in Britain?
I'm not sure that that hadn't better be addressed in the first place to Mr. Gaitskell.
No, I think the questioner is quite wrong about this. I absolutely agree with what Mr. Bevan said a little time ago. We do really argue about our policy, and we do it in a very high-spirited manner. A lot of hard knocks are given and taken, and always have been at our party conferences. But I should have thought that any shrewd observer of the political situation in the Labour Party at the moment could rule out at once the question of any split in the Labour Party. We shall maybe continue to argue about details of the programme. The executive, if I may say so, will do very well if they produce a programme that everybody accepts without argument. And indeed, it would probably be a very bad programme if they did produce anything of the kind. But those arguments, which we will no doubt take part in, certainly should not lead anybody to suppose that there is a split of any kind whatever.
You see, you must remember that what we are doing now is using the language of our opponents. When we talk about splits in the Labour Party, what they really are speaking about are discussions and disagreements inside the Labour Party. Well, now, if you want to have a real idea of what a split looks like, and of how what language is used by the gentlemen when they really do quarrel with each other, read what Mr. Churchill said about his Conservative colleagues before the war. I never said anything as bad as that.
We might ask for one more supplementary before we go on to the next question.
Mr. Bevan, no doubt, appreciates the national independence of Great Britain. Why Great Britain or the British government has such savage measure against the Malian and the other colonial liberation movement?
Well, precisely because we do not believe here that progress towards democracy and self-government can be achieved by methods that we have had to fight in Malaya. We do not believe, to use the old Bakunin anarchist formula, we do not believe in propaganda by deed. We believe in counting heads, not breaking them. And therefore, we have to resist this situation in Malaya. And we think that the methods that are being adopted in Malaya by the opponents of British administration are now gravely delaying the advance of Malayan people towards effective self-government.
Well, now, I wonder if we could have the next question now from Mr.
Osman Bindin from Malaya. Mr. Chairman, my question is this. In view of the present world conditions, what particular policies of the present government would the Socialist Party change if it came to power to raise the country's standard of living?
Well, Mr. Osman Din of Malaya, in view of the present world conditions, what particular policies of the present government would the Socialist Party change if it came into power to raise the country's standard of living? Mr. Gaitskell?
Well, in the first place, I think you should understand that I don't believe simply raising our standard of living should be our sole or even our main objective in the next period of power. We have before us a great task of development here, development in the Commonwealth, assisting the development in the underdeveloped areas of the world. And I'm quite sure that it's not going to be possible to carry that out, as well as maintain a defense program, on which I think Mr. Bevan and I would agree, in a continuing Cold War, and also have, at any rate, a substantial improvement in our standard of living. I thought I'd better get that clear at the start. But on the other hand, I certainly think we should change various policies of the present government. What is happening in Britain at the moment, at any rate, is that for the first time since the war, production is falling below last year's level, unemployment is rising, investment is being curtailed, and the prospect of being able to carry out the sort of policies that I've been indicated on that kind of basis is obviously a very dim one. And I would have said that we ought in the first place to revert to the kind of policies we had when we were in office. Now, what we were trying to do really here was to maintain a high level of employment, an encouragement, the maximum encouragement to production, and at the same time not hesitate to use controls of various kinds. Building licensing was one of them, and incidentally the government have announced today a very important relaxation in building licensing. Building licensing, import controls, raw material allocations, rationing for that matter, holding down consumption at home in various ways to prevent inflation. We pursued that sort of policy, and I think in the production field, everybody agrees, it was extremely successful. And therefore, that would be the broad direction, I think, in which we should have to change the policies of the present government. Of course, those aren't the only changes we should have to make. We've already discussed what we would do about nationalisation and public ownership. And let me say here that our case for nationalisation rests in part on broad principles, which we've discussed already, but also in individual industries. We can, I think, make out an extremely good case for the fact that it also is a condition of rising productivity. Finally, of course, one must not overlook the perhaps even more fundamental difference between the conservatives and the socialists here. And that is that we are socialists and believe, that is to say, in a socially just community, in equality as our aim, in creating a state of affairs in which a man's position in life does not depend upon the accident of birth, but insofar as there are differences, is dependent on merit or need. We made, and during our period of office, I would say, quite a substantial advance towards those ideals. And we should certainly desire to resume that advance as soon as we got back into power.
Mr. Bevan?
Well, I think the world is in a very, very critical condition. And that very many people are failing to recognize what is at the basis of a great deal of unrest in different parts of the world. I do not believe, and I think that Mr. Gaitskill would agree with this, I do not believe it is possible in the Middle East and in the Far East for representative democratic institutions to find firm root if those nations are expected to assemble their own surpluses to build up their, what I would like to call, social furniture. I believe that America and Great Britain and Europe will have to assist those nations to find the equipment of modern society if those nations are not to slip back into some form of totalitarian government. And that just means that the people of Great Britain, and I think eventually the people of the United States, have got to be told that their standard of living has to stand still for some time until the rest of the world has been able to make a bit more progress. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a very hard thing for us to learn. It's a very hard thing for us to teach. It will be one of the greatest tests of democracy in Great Britain if we can get our people to do that for 4 or 5 years until we are able to build up more investment here and abroad. That's the test.
Well, now, are there any questions, supplementary questions on those two very, very interesting answers? Well, if not, We'll go on to the next question, which comes from Mr.
Farman Farmian from Persia or Iran. According to Karl Marx, the doctrine of the British Socialist Party will change to communism. Is one right in thinking so?
That comes from Mr. Farman of Persia. The question is, according to Karl Marx, the doctrine of the British Socialist Party will change into communism. Is one right in thinking so? Mr. Bevan?
Well, you know, for a very long time, indeed ever since the days of Karl Marx, communism and socialism have been interchangeable terms. And what Karl Marx meant by communism was not what Stalin means by communism. As a matter of fact, both Engels and Marx and Bebel believed in democracy. They did not believe in dictatorship. There are references, of course, to the dictatorship of the proletariat and the withering away of the state and things of that sort. But if you read the Communist Manifesto, what you are struck by is its extraordinary optimism. You are struck by the fact that both Engels and Karl Marx believed that the people only had to come to recognize the absurdities of capitalist society and they would immediately sweep them away. In fact, Marx was very much under the influence of the rationalist thinking of the 19th century. And the Communist Manifesto will be quite ununderstandable unless you remember that he spoke and wrote against that background. Now, I therefore think that we have to speak of communism not didactically, not by reference to what people thought it was, but by reference to what to how it is being carried out. And therefore we now today make a distinction. We speak of communism as the sort of thing that Russia is doing. We speak of socialism as the sort of thing that we are trying to bring about. And between those two, there is a very, very considerable difference. But of course, there are all kinds of other different experiments taking place too. There is no resemblance, as far as I can see myself, between the agrarian communism of China and the urban communism of Russia. Not the slightest. Karl Marx wouldn't be able to recognize it at the present time. because there are different nations at different stages of development, and therefore the application of principles will always have to be modified by local conditions. I myself think, quite frankly, it was a tragedy that the principles of socialism had to be first of all applied in a country so backward as Russia. And the world has suffered a great deal from that ever since. And I therefore think that we must speak of these things now as meaning different different modes of thought and modes of political activity.
Well, I think we might ask Mr. Gaitskill if he feels that there's any danger of British socialism changing into communism.
Not the slightest. Of course, you know, I suppose, the British labour movement has never really been much influenced by Marx. And I agree with Mr. Bevan that there's a considerable doubt in any case as to whether he would have supported the present Russian form of communism. But we were never influenced by it. We, I think, owe our strength, firstly, to the trade union movement and a rather simple and straightforward desire by organized labor to improve the conditions of labor, and secondly to socialist doctrine of an idealistic kind springing in part from early socialist writers here and in part, quite frankly, from Christianity. Non-conformist church in this country has always played a very large part in the labor movement, and that gives us a completely different background. We are, after all, a very practical people. We are not a very imaginative people, except, of course, the Welsh. But in the main, we manage to keep them under control. We allow their imaginations to run riot in a limited sphere. But apart from that, we aren't terribly interested in doctrinal considerations. Now, the only other point I think I would make is this. As Mr. Bevan has said, this is really partly a question of words. What we mean by communism today is something promoted by the Communist Party. And the Communist Party is simply the instrument of the Soviet government in every country. And, of course, here as much as anywhere else. And therefore, if one is taking this sentence, the sentence which was put in the question, as it stands, and it implies, do we think the Communist Party here is going to get control of the Labour Party? Certainly not. They occasionally, in my view, as I have said, in particular instances, create some influence. They have had some influence in the unions, and maybe some in some local parties. But by and large, they have always remained a tiny minority here. They haven't been able to return a single member of parliament. Nearly all their candidates lost their deposits at the last election, and I see, therefore, no possible chance or danger of communism capturing the British Socialist Party.
Well, before we have too much discussion on lost deposits, I think we have got to the stage where we might, I'm afraid, come to the end of this very interesting meeting of the Asian Club. But I know that you will agree with me when I say that we would like to thank Mr. Bevan and Mr. Gateskill very sincerely indeed for coming along tonight to answer our questions in the way they have. Thank you and good night.